how do we reconcile what appear to be contradictory teachings? So what do we do with that? And where I started last time was the fact that there is a long teaching, a long sutta that the historical Buddha gave, which is entitled "What the Teachings Are Not." And I always really appreciated that, because it's very easy to have an uninformed, an uneducated idea about what the Buddha is either directly saying or implying. So in that sutta, he goes through and he's very explicit about a whole series of teachings, and makes the point, both then and repeatedly in other suttas, that what practice is about, whether it's on the cushion or in daily life, in relationship with other people, is about paying attention, how we pay attention, and particularly what we pay attention to. And he makes the point that if we pay attention to, from his perspective, the wrong things, the unskillful things, if we are led primarily by our emotions and desire and aversion, that they lead directly to what are traditionally called the five hindrances. So more desire, more aversion, anxiety, doubt, confusion. So it's very clear from those set of suttas that the Buddha is putting the responsibility on each one of us for our own experience and for educating ourselves about what the teachings are about and how to apply them. For me, this really implies something quite important, and it's being an informed student and an informed practitioner. Having a sound program of study, listening to good teachers, so that when we have an opinion, and when we pick something up and we read it, we know how to, this is going to be largely my next talk, but we know how to frame it from a Dharmic or Buddhist perspective, as opposed to a traditional, personalized, narrative, story-based perspective. All the teachings are trying to undermine the enormous tendency of narcissism to interpret everything as personal. And the psychology that the Buddha used is a completely impersonal psychology. It's sensory-based. He's always talking about sense experience, and that consciousness and then perception arises from sensation in the body. So everything starts from sensation in the body. And then there is a progression of how consciousness arises, perception arises, how that perception is colored, how desire and aversion arise, how the mind begins to attach things and then becomes identified. But it all starts with sensation in the body. And there's reason in our tradition that there's so much instruction about the body. If you take the beginning meditation class, the whole first several sets of classes are about going back to the body. Whatever it is, whether it's a thought, an emotion, the breath, it's trying to experience the experience at the earliest possible point in the body. And the reason for that is that you have the greatest possibility of understanding it from that perspective and not getting lost in the attachment or desire, aversion, or identification. Okay, so like in the Kalama Sutta, which is very famous, where the Buddha talks about don't believe something for a whole series of reasons, because it's in a text or because of a particular teacher or because the teaching coincides with what you would like the teaching to be. This whole series of things. all sounds very familiar to me. And then he says, you know, the test is your own experience. And you'll hear people and teachers, some teachers interpret that sutta as saying, well, the real test is your personal subjective experience. That's not what that sutta says at all. Because the sutta is held in the context of the teachings, and what the Buddha is always talking about is not our personal subjective experience. He's talking about our personal direct experience of sensation in the body, which then leads through this dependent origination, which is all cause and effect. And so it's a very powerful thing if you can get a hold of it, because it tends to objectify the experience that you're having. And it allows us to see how reactive we are and how much we're adding on to our experience, particularly how much suffering we're adding on, because we're coloring it all. So that's the predicate for the rest of the talk. So tonight what I'm going to do is talk about the Metta-sutta and the Metta-phrases, because I love them, I think they're interesting, and they're completely unique in the Theravadin tradition. Okay, so you have a series of phrases that are repeated. There is a traditional order of objects or individuals that you address them to, yourself, a mentor, a close friend, a neutral person, a person that you have trouble with. Okay? The most common traditional instruction involves visualization of the person. And for those who aren't particularly adept at visualization, you're encouraged to actually have a heartfelt sense of the person that you're conveying the essence or the meaning of these phrases to. So at first glance, you know, it's one thing you say, okay, well, you know, there's a series of instructions and I'll follow them and try them. Back to the informed student idea, what I just said, you know, repetition of phrases, visualization, and, you know, it's may you be safe and protected. May I be safe and may you be healthy and strong. May you be able to care for yourself and live with ease. These are all projections of a particular set of desires. And so at least on the surface, if you're thinking at all about the instruction you've received, it seems to violate all the instructions we've received. So I wrote down just a few of them, you know. So one is, we're always told we're supposed to experience things as they are and not add anything on, right? I mean, the most basic instruction you always hear. And here, we don't know what the condition of the other person is. If we're doing metta for another person, we may think we do, but we're not sure. And so what are we doing? We are adding on this wish, which would what? I mean, and particularly if we know the person's not healthy or not happy, we want the condition changed. I mean, that's the implication of it, right? So just like there couldn't be anything more not experience things exactly as they are. Right? We're told to avoid creating something, particularly not using imagination or visualization. And in the beginning meditation class, that's always a big issue, because so many people have, even in simple hatha yoga classes, you know, there's the instruction of, you know, feeling your, you know, breath all the way down in your body, you know. And I mean, it's a nice idea, and it's an image. Biologically, I think it's a little questionable. So, you know, here, we're trying to create a different state of mind or state of body or a different presence or a different future, either for ourselves or another person. You know, we're just kind of beat up over the idea that desire is a hindrance, and that we shouldn't be desiring certain things. And then here, this is couldn't be more clearly an expression of desire. You know, may I be safe and protected. May I be peaceful and happy. And it almost sounds like an affirmation. And it's interesting because in the beginning classes, I'm just getting ready to teach the beginning class again. And, you know, we'll have people and they'll say, well, this is like the affirmations that I do. And then they'll say some group that they're in. And, of course, these aren't anything like affirmations. That's not what their intention is at all. So how do we reconcile these kinds of fundamental instructions with this metta approach in particular? I think the first thing that is really interesting and helpful to reflect on as an informed practitioner is what the Buddha himself, to the degree that we know, you know, we accept all the limitations of history and what survived, but what is surviving of what the Buddha himself said about a particular topic. And on this one, there is no evidence at all any place that the historical Buddha recommended that the current model that we use, okay, visualizations or the use of phrases, within maybe 200 years of the death of the Buddha, we know that there were something like 22 different schools that came out of what we now identify as Theravadin. And there is what we call the Pali Canon, the canon for the first original teachings. Each of those schools had a Pali Canon. By and large, the canons are all pretty much the same. There are a limited difference in emphasis, and then in one school, which eventually became the Mahayana school, there are real differences. But everybody else, those canons are amazingly similar. And so in none of those canons is there anything about using these phrases or about using visualizations, okay? So how did we get here, you know? And why in this particular school that doesn't use any of these things, as a rule, do we have it? All of the Pali canons that I referred to generally refer to a sutta that the historical Buddha gave that involved the monks, you know, back at the time of the Buddha. And if you go to India, as a lot of us have on a pilgrimage, you get to see some of what the conditions were like. And it wasn't only agrarian at the time of the Buddha. It was forested and small jungles where he was. So the sutta involves the monks having to go back to the monastery through the forest. And at that time, there were still lots of wild tigers and lions and I'm sure skunks and all kinds of things. And so the monks come back and basically say, hey, you know, we were just like scared to death coming back through the forest, you know, like what are we supposed to do with that? And then the Buddha talks about, well, you know, what you can do is open your heart and you can radiate out unconditional care to whoever these scary voices are that you can't see in the woods. And, you know, if you do that, it creates an openness in your heart and it will dampen the fear that you have. Okay, so that original sutta is what the teachings really are. They're not about, well, open your heart and, you know, all of the animals that want to eat you suddenly are going to lose their appetite. That's not the sutta, okay? The sutta is that it will help you, it will change your framing of the experience, and as a result, you will conduct yourself differently. And it may be that as that change will affect. But it's not that somehow, you know, it's not like, well, I'm praying for someone and then going, that's not at all the theory behind this. And I've told this story before, and if you've heard it before, I apologize, but I like it. And I think it makes this point where Joseph Goldstein making this point about when you're radiating out the phrase to someone else, you're not actually trying to change them. You're trying to create a new inner condition in yourself. So he says that at IMS, at the center back east, you know, he would always take this long walk, and there was a forest, which is now a little forest monastery. But he'd walk around the forest, and, you know, there were some houses, and there was always this one dog. And there was a white picket fence, and, you know, every time he'd get there, the dog would, you know, come off the porch and run up to the fence, and the whole time he walked in front of the fence, the dog would be growling and barking at him and everything, you know. So he said, okay, well, you know, what I'm going to start doing is that'll be part of my metta practice. So every time he'd get there, he knew the dog was going to start growling, and he'd start doing the metta, you know, and looking at the dog and opening his heart and everything, you know, and he thought like he was really having an effect on the dog, you know. And so, you know, after a couple of months of this, you know, he tells a precursor story about when he was practicing in Bodh Gaya in India, how this little houseboy was stealing his fruit. And so he used him as his object of metta. And he became so affectionate towards this little thief that every time he saw him, he just kind of lit up, and that he believes that it changed their relationship. You know, like the little boy saw, like, wow, this guy really likes me, you know, and he stopped stealing from him. He stopped stealing his fruit from him. So I guess the idea was, well, the same thing is going to happen with this little dog, okay? So this day he goes, and, you know, the dog starts barking, it runs out. Joseph walks by, you know, may you be peaceful and happy, and the gate was open. You know, so it comes out and it bites him in the ass. So that's the story he uses, like, you know, what we're doing isn't about getting the dog not to want to bite me. It's about here. It's in here that you're cultivating, you know. And this is, last time I talked about bhavana, cultivation, which happens in one of two ways. Either you are cultivating a quality of mind through making choices and doing things, or you're cultivating through refraining from doing things that are unskillful or unhealthy. So the fundamental purpose of this approach is all of Buddhist practice is cause and effect. It's about creating conditions which lead to something happening. That's how consciousness arises. Okay, there's a point of contact with a sensation, consciousness arises, perception arises from that, and then depending on the conditions that are present, the perception is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then if you see that or don't see it, then something else happens, something else. And at each stage, we have the opportunity of intervening and making a choice. So here, the idea is through repetition of not just the phrases. It's not that we're trying to repeat phrases, although we're repeating them a lot. The idea is that with the repetition of each phrase, that there is a deep aspiration, not just a desire. You know, it's not a sensual desire. That's what is the negative in Buddhist practice. This is a deep aspiration for the conditions to be in our life or other person's lives that lead to the reduction in suffering and lead to a satisfying and happy life. So in the purest sense, what this is about is trying to develop in our own mind and our own heart a new baseline for how we are relating to an engaging experience, which is just like a huge job, you know, because particularly, you know, if you're a person who has been skeptical or aversive or suspicious or fearful or anxious in your life, is there anybody else in the room? But if you've had those kind of qualities at work as a significant part of your life, you have a baseline of immediately reacting in a certain way. And so we're actually going beneath that. We're not just trying to retrain that. We're actually trying to plant the seed for this most affirmative way of engaging and seeing and understanding experience. And so the Buddha talks repeatedly about if you're in community, you know, there's this sutta on dealing with and resolving conflict in Sangha. And his first recommendation isn't something to do to resolve conflict. His first recommendation is what you do so that the conflict won't arise, or if it does, that it will be held in this deep form of kindness and openness through doing metta for everyone in the Sangha, whether you like them or don't like them, whether you had a conflict with them or not, that you should be, when you think of people in your Sangha and when you are with them, you should be radiating metta to them. I mean, it's quite a sutta, you know. So the repetition of these phrases comes with trying to actually touch and feel this deeper aspiration in your, at a sensual level, at a body-based level. So to go through the phrases, there's a number of different traditional ways to do it, but the way that I was taught is, the first one is, may you be safe and protected from all types of harms and danger. So just the most fundamental and deepest wish for ourselves or anyone that we care about, because without that, it's hard for anything else to really exist. I mean, if we don't feel safe and we don't feel protected, it's hard to feel open. It's hard to feel caring for other people. It's difficult to take risks. So that first one is just the most fundamental thing about living and living in community. May you be peaceful and happy. So that's mental and psychological. That's the intention, okay, that the mind is infused with peacefulness and happiness. Okay, may you be healthy and strong. Okay, so that's directed at the body, right? And it's not, you know, once again, this isn't like trying to change the other person. So this isn't like fantasy stuff, you know, like somebody is dying of a terminal illness. You know, the phrase, may you be healthy and strong, isn't some kind of a fantasy that you're trying to ignore that or override it or change it. It's basically, may you be as strong and as healthy as you are capable of being under the circumstance. You know, in whatever condition we're at, there's a level of health that can be present, you know. May you be able to care for yourself and live with ease. You know, once again, kind of the other part of the security piece, right? You know, because I feel safe and because my mind is happy and peaceful and my body has some level of strength and quality to it, that I am able to settle into the conditions of my life, to accept those, to be satisfied, and to care for myself to the degree that I can. And then those are all metta phrases, and then very commonly, actually a compassion phrase is added on to the end, which is, may you or may we or may I be free from suffering. Okay. So all of those are these deep aspiration, and so the first thing that we're trying to do is we're trying to actually connect that phrase with the feeling of what it means at its deepest level in our body and in our mind, our heart. So when you are repeating these phrases and this starts to work, it takes a while to get it, it has a very distinct and identifiable physical feeling. There's a feeling of lightness, of openness and expansion, of non-judgment. Frequently there's a feeling of warmth, not in the sense of like, gee, I feel hot or I'm sweating, but in the emotional sense of warmth. Because it is, and this goes back to the idea of being a good student, this is not a personal narrative-based quality of mind. So we may feel all of those things. I may feel all of those things every single time I think about my grandson. But from that particular place, if I think about the person that I'm in a big fight with and I think is being unethical, I don't have the same feeling. Okay? With metta, this sense of openness and warmth and lightness is present regardless of who the object is, who the person is that you're calling up, because it is unintentional. It is a universal openness. And these wishes are to the human condition. You know, and I always used to say, you know, Saddam Hussein isn't around anymore, I guess. But, you know, when he was in and everybody thought that he was, you know, kind of the worst person on earth, I don't know who that is now. But everybody seemed to think that at the time, you know. I mean, you'd bring that name up and people would be reacting. And I always say this, I said, you know, Saddam Hussein is like a wonderful object for metta. You know, and people kind of think you're a little crazy. And the person who thinks you're crazy is stuck in the personal perspective. It's like, well, how could I wish Saddam Hussein good health and well-being? You know, he's this terrible, cruel person. And if Saddam Hussein at some point in his life, maybe as a child, had actually felt safe and protected and peaceful and happy and healthy and strong, maybe he wouldn't have turned out to be Saddam Hussein. I mean, this is the power of these phrases. I mean, these things, if we could create them in our lives or another life, are transformative, absolutely transformative. So that's what we're trying to touch. And Ram Dass always used to use the illustration of it being the sun. You know, the sun is shining on everybody. It makes everyone warm. It doesn't exclude anybody. So metta is inclusive. So the first reason that we do this is we're actually trying to experience that, so that we understand what this is. Because it's a nice set of phrases to think about and contemplate and reflect. That's not what it's about. It's about actually a feeling in the body and a feeling in the mind and the heart. So equally, and this is, I have found maybe the most educational part about it, it's experiencing what metta is not. Because, you know, you'll move through these categories, you know, like yourself, a mentor, someone who's with no concern for themselves, has looked after you, you know, maybe a loving uncle or an aunt or someone, an older person, a guide, a close friend. And you'll call somebody up who, you know, you is just like this really close friend, right? I mean, they just, you love them and they love you and everything. And you'll start to do the phrases and you'll feel kind of pissed off. I mean, that always blows my mind when that happens, you know. You say, well, what's going on, you know? Well, it's obviously not metta, you know, if I'm kind of saying, you know, may you be safe and protected, you jerk. You know? But what it does is it's I have found, and I think many people do find, that this practice is a real it's a radar, it's a detection system to tell you when you have unresolved issues with another person, something that you haven't processed or addressed, and whether you need to or can is a whole separate issue, but it really identifies things. So when that happens, I mean, it's so stark, because, you know, there was several mentors, people in my early life that were very influential as a young person. And when I would do metta for them, you know, I would put myself back in those situations, and it would just like, you know, like, oh man. I just feel like I'm being bathed by, you know, affection. And then I would move to someone else who I would fully expect to have the same experience, and then have one of these kinds of experiences that I'm describing. So it's like kind of, at first it was really shocking for me, you know. And then now I understand, it was confusing actually. And now I understand what's going on, and know how to explore it. But that piece completely informs the other experience, because it so radically defines what openness and unconditionality and inclusion feels like, and then doesn't feel like. You know, and you realize that it's a question of expansion or contraction. It's energetic, both on the body and the mind, right? You know, and so once again, we're back to sensation. So the earlier you can start to feel the contraction, or the earlier you can start to feel the expansion, you can make some decisions. You know, you can make the decision to promote the expansion, the inclusiveness and the acceptance and non-judgment. And when you feel the contraction, if it's appropriate, you know, maybe you should be contracting. You know, maybe it's a situation where you should protect yourself. But most of the time, when you feel that contraction, once you start to practice for a while, it's a sign that that's going to take you to a place that's going to make you less skillful. You know, that you can maintain considerable openness and non-defensiveness and acceptance and non-judgment, and not get hurt. You know, so the practice is all about gradients. You know, there's not just desire or aversion. You know, desire is this very, very, very wide range of experience. From you have a thought, oh, that'd be nice, to you're obsessed with something. If I don't get that, I'm not going to be okay. And the same with anger. You know, it's an annoyance or outright hate. Well, between those two poles are huge, if you can develop the ability to experience sensation in your body, in your mind, in your heart. And that's the reason this can be so effective with pain. You know, like this. The same thing happened this time for surgery with me that happened with my knees. But, you know, they just, you know, it's like they're conditioning you to feel a lot of pain. You know, this is going to be, you know, you're going to have these bladder spasms, and here's a special medication just for that pain. Oh, okay. Let's make it special, you know. And, you know, the minute you say anything, they want to give you these really heavy-duty atomic bombs of pain control. And so, you know, I've really worked with this idea of a spectrum, with pain, and whether something is unpleasant or uncomfortable as opposed to it's actually painful. And that's a huge spectrum, you know. So, you know, like on this surgery, I had a lot of discomfort and unpleasantness. I didn't have at least what I would consider very much pain, and took almost no medication, you know. So in the hospital, you know, the nurses, you know, kept saying, oh, poof, you know, if it's uncomfortable, you know, take two of these, you know. I mean, one of them knocks me out. Take two of these because you have to get ahead of it, you know. Well, the second part of the advice is fantastic. It's the same thing I was saying. The earlier you can catch something, the greater opportunity you have to work with it. So, you know, I was ready. I was really ready for this, you know. I mean, I really worked hard. Start to feel a sensation, you know. Man, I just drop everything. That's where my attention is. Just focus on that, okay? Like, what actually am I experiencing? Have a lot of discomfort, but very little pain, you know. So, and I think that's possible. Now, there's some kinds of things with the, when I had my knee surgeries, I mean, there's some serious pain. there's no way you're just going to reframe yourself out of that. Having said that, the experience that you can have compared to what the majority of people have is significantly different in terms of the amount of medication you have to take and all of that. So this idea that we're trying to, through metta and really all of practice, but it's so clear here, that we're trying to specifically experience this wide open, inclusive, warm, accepting state of mind, and then understanding that through when the mind starts to close down, shows you that spectrum, and then you can start to play with that. It's a wonderful practice, and like most practices, it laps over into everything else, you know, as you start to see that in terms of you know, openness and inclusivity. That's a range, you know. I mean, here I'm just totally wide open. I'm just you know it's like unbelievable. And there's other times where you'll experience that, but rather than being this big, it'll be that big. They're both openness and inclusivity, but they're different levels. So then when you start to see that, it starts to change everything. It starts to change how you look at your emotions. And it starts to change how you look at the power of thought to influence an emotion and a sensation in your body. You know, you start calibrating it kind of based on this spectrum. And then you suddenly have a whole new way of being able to relate to and manage all of this. Okay, so let's see. So I talked about I think I already talked about the idea that this is about trying to create the conditions which lead to a fundamental change. So it's important, and this is back to cause and effect, when we do this practice and other practice, we're not trying to change ourselves, which is the quintessential Western model, right? Right, yeah. 21 days, change a habit. That's all it is. I mean, I don't have to think about it. I just have to do something for 21 days and I'll have a new habit, you know. Well, that's not this at all. What this is about is that you change conditions in your life, and that leads to changes in the way that you see and understand things, which leads to changes in behavior. So if you eliminate that first part, the second two parts are all cognitive. This is not a cognitive practice. So here, if you actually start to feel, you know, just spontaneously, and you do, you know, you look out at people, and it's fascinating. You know, you look out, who knows why, there's just one person, and it's like, what comes into your mind is, boy, I really hope that you can be happy. you know, I hope that the conditions in your life allow you to be safe. You know, you see somebody suffering, just spontaneously, it starts to happen. It starts to happen all the time. Well, then that really starts to lead to other things. But the condition that leads to that is this repetition of phrases and practice and what have you. So it's a little counterintuitive because it's the result itself is so intuitive. But it's all about what. What am I talking about right now? It's like the most fundamental thing in Buddhist practice. It's I and starts with I. Six letters. It's an intention. Okay, so intention is the forerunner of everything, right? And this answers the question, well, how can somebody really, really practice and then do really harmful things, you know, engage in kind of nasty speech and what have you? It's the issue of intention. You know, it takes a lot of work to clean up your intention. And that's what you start to see with this. Because this is about, you know, everybody, even the person that I really, really dislike. I'm going to wish them well. I'm not going to be stupid, but I'm going to wish them well, you know. And then you can see, I don't want to wish them well. I mean, and what is that? That's an intention. So this is striking at intention, and from a Buddhist perspective, intention is the key driver of karma, of consequences. So once again, this practice is like so rich in what's going on. And I think understanding it from that perspective is so helpful, because then you appreciate how potentially significant working with this can be, even though it may be difficult for you. And then I just want to put in a pitch for a repetition, okay? Because we all know how difficult it is to make change in our lives. And here, I mean, we're talking about really the deepest form of change, really fundamental changes. So I've always been fascinated, you know, if you go to monasteries or go on pilgrimages overseas, you'll bump into monks or really serious practitioners, and they're working their mala, you know, their beads, or they're chanting a mantra. And on the first pilgrimage we did to India, in the morning we would go sit at the temple, the Bodhi temple, where the historical Buddha, supposedly, it's a spot where he sat under the Bodhi tree and became enlightened. And lots of people are there early in the morning. And there's this one great big marble piece where a lot of people will sit on the marble. So I just took my tape recorder and turned it on, sat it next to me for an hour. And it's fascinating, you know, because picking up so many things, you know, there's birds and what have you. But what it really picked up was a number of different monks who were just to themselves, you know, not trying to chant or get a whole thing going, just very quietly working their beads, mantras over and over and over and over and over and over again. And so whether it's, Tibetan or whatever tradition it is, I've always been fascinated with the question, well, what is that? Because it seems so, it seems non-cognitive. It seems like non-thoughtful. It seems almost robotic, you know. And so what's really going on? And what's really going on, if it's being done right, is what I was talking about here. You know, every one of those beads, every one of those phrases of that mantra the person is connecting to this very deep place in themselves over and over and over and over and over again. So this just keeps getting piercing deeper and deeper and deeper into their heart and into the tissue of their body and into their thoughts and their emotions at every level. And so that's always been instructive for me, because there's one thing for, at the end of a talk or at the beginning of a sitting or what have you, to do a little metta and feel good about it. And I think that's valuable. But if we're talking about the kinds of potential changes that I've been talking about tonight, then you actually have to practice it and set time apart and do some of this deep repetitive work. And it can be really, really, really enjoyable, metta can. There's some people who have a theory that, and I mean, some teachers say this, I think this is kind of joking, but they say, the Buddha invented metta as a way of rewarding monks for all the hard work and of, this labor of just paying attention all the time, because it can feel so wonderful, it really can. If your mind isn't balanced in the right place, it can just be an enormous amount of work, and it can be exhausting because your mind isn't actually connecting, so that rather than kind of like a freeing opening experience, it really becomes labor. And then you have to see that and kind of get out of there. Like, that's not what you're supposed to be doing, But the once again, the repetition tells you a lot, because if you see that you go in and what normally happens is that you start to feel heavy and weighted down and you start to get tired and have difficulty concentrating, almost assuredly an indication that what's happening is your mind is moving into clinging and attachment. That rather than coming from this place where I'm trying to cultivate these states of mind in myself, now I've shifted over to like, no, I actually want those things to happen. So those are the indications, because once again, expansion and contraction, what happens when we start to cling and attach and identify? You just, right? Just keep getting more and more work, no openness, no ease. And so practicing regularly, even if it's only 15 minutes, but doing that regularly over and over, you start to see these trends. Where if you just do it like once a week or something, you probably won't see what I just said, It'll just be confusing. So, okay, so those are my thoughts on that for this evening. So thoughts, comments, questions? Sure. And I want to say at the outset that this is much more than semantics. Okay? So another word for intention would be motivation. Okay? So it has to do with a baseline of how we're relating to the world and other people frequently that is below our level of awareness. So the illustration I gave earlier is, how can the good practitioner who's a great person in certain parts of their life just be so nasty and negative? And it's because of certain life experiences, they have developed a way of responding, either trying to defend themselves or, to crush another person or whatever it is, that is really, really unskillful and unhealthy and clearly aren't in touch with that. But that is their motivation and intent when they're confronted with a certain set of circumstances. So we frequently have competing intentions. So at least from a Buddhist perspective, we're talking about these deep motivations, and for desire or aversion, we're talking about more kind of temporary states of mind that appear in relationship to a set of circumstances. Does that help at all?
Being drawn, like, I'd really like to have a piece of chocolate cake right now, you know, or...
Yeah, that wouldn't be a motivation.
That's motivation?
That would not be a motivation.
Oh, yeah, that would be a desire.
A desire, yeah, you know.
But more short distractibilities?
Yes.
You're saying desire is more distractible?
Yeah.
Kind of lack of attention?
Yeah, an intention is a deep motivation. And you know, and it bears saying out, you know, I started with the issue of being, saying, you know, well, you want to be an informed practitioner, okay? Well, the fact that some other tradition defines desire or intention in a different way than the historical Buddha defined it, and it is used in this tradition, it means, and I'm not being smart or anything, it just doesn't mean anything to me at all, because my responsibility sitting here is to talk about those terms and practices from the perspective of Theravadan Buddhism. Okay? So if somebody else has a different definition, that's fine, but it's not what we're teaching. You follow me?
Yes, I am following.
Yeah, so I'm not making a value judgment, okay?
Yeah.
But it's important to know the difference, you know, because like some of the things, I think like some of the things I talked about tonight with Metta are really significant. And if you don't know those, then when you practice Metta, it's easy to get confused, you know?
Well,
so
that's kind of why I'm asking you the question, because I've had, you know, new to this philosophy over the last year, let's say.
Yes.
And had different input and terminology. So for me, this clarifies things a little bit more about desire versus motivation or intention or focus.
Right. Yeah. So thank you for your question. And, you know, I can say, and I think everybody will back me up on this, it really takes a while to kind of get your feet down on the ground. And it's even more of a problem now, you know, like in this, I really thought a lot about what I'm going to do with this beginning class. Because the first beginning meditation class, this will be my 20th year of teaching every year beginning meditation classes. When I first started, you had to be careful about the language you used. You know, everybody thought it was religion and all. You know, now everything is mindfulness. And so people are coming into these classes with all kinds of ideas. And the largest kind of popular distributed magazine right now is called Mindfulness. And the editor did an editorial several months ago, and it was about, well, what is mindfulness? And he says, well, it's just impossible to define mindfulness, okay? Which I guess is very convenient if you're the publisher of a magazine, because then everything in the magazine, you know? Well, you know, and the point that I'm going to make, you know, I'm not, the beginning class, I'm not teaching a Buddhist class, but I am teaching Buddhist mindfulness. Because what's happened, and it's actually happened now, is with mindfulness, the same thing has happened that happened with Hatha Yoga. You know, when Hatha Yoga first came here, it was one of the limbs of traditional Hindu practice. It was one of the avenues of spiritual awakening. Well, we just denuded it, you know. And I'm not saying that Hatha Yoga as a physical discipline isn't a fabulous thing. It is. And I'm not saying that here individual people can't go in and use it as a spiritual practice. What I am saying is that's not the way our society is holding it. And that's what's happened with mindfulness. You know, everything is mindfulness-based something, which should tell you it's not Buddhist mindfulness. You know, like, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is not Buddhist. Buddhism has a totally different psychological base than cognitive therapy does. Now, that doesn't mean there's anything wrong with that. In fact, I think it's great, okay? But what it is people really get confused. You know, there's like all of this stuff, this is mindfulness, that's mindfulness. Well, they're different. They're really different. So here, at least from my perspective, I'm trying to keep my finger in the dike and teach what I think is the closest that is available that we know that was offered by the historical Buddha. You know. So.
Dennis, could you talk a moment about intention as choice? It seems that the metta is an act of choice. May you be, may I be. It's making a choice in an aspirational
way. Yes.
And that choice seems to relate to intention that then can focus.
Yeah. So that's a great question, okay? Because it shows, it speaks to the progression of the way metta works and actually the way a lot of the practices work, okay? So like the instruction of being willing to just be with things the way they are and observe them. Well, that's just not a normal tendency for most of us, okay? But after practice and practice and practice and you do this, suddenly you find yourself all the time being willing just to be there with something that is painful or unpleasant, because you know if you just attend to it, that you will get sufficient experiential information to make a sound choice. Where if you jump in, that you won't. So, you know, that kind of happens and jumps and starts here. This actually starts as a conscious effort to plant a seed, and then you do start making choices. You know, you get into an elevator, and as a young prosecutor, I remember getting in an elevator. There was a supervisor who had been particularly mean to me, and I'm not sure if this is true or not, you know. Fact or fiction, but I certainly was convinced that he had been very mean and he had gone out of his way to try to hurt me. And so I remember when I first started doing metta, getting in the elevator, standing right next to him, and sitting there doing metta for him, you know, and feeling, wow, this is really hard. But so it starts like that. And then the progression of it is pretty soon, as I said, you know, you just driving down the freeway and somebody goes by you really fast, and you know, where before you'd be upset by it, now you know, you actually totally genuinely going, gee, you know, I really hope that you're safe and protected. That's really scary, you know, but the urge starts to change. So it changes on small things, and then it just starts getting progressively more and more where it does that. So like many elements of practice, it starts with it's an intentional practice to try to create a condition. And then it actually begins to become part of the baseline of how we engage experience. Yeah, I've always found it just like a fascinating and kind of an extraordinary thing when you see that, you know, particularly this element where earlier you would be angry or you'd get angry, and here you actually respond with kindness and compassion, you know, because you see the risk that the other person is creating for themselves and others, and you know that you've done that, and you know how painful it is and how you've hurt yourself and others. So,
I hesitate to ask this question because it's kind of a nerdy historical question. But I had the impression that the Buddha's original Sangha was not doing metta practice the way we do it. But this is not to question the value of it, because I don't question the value of it, but they must have done something to kind of open themselves to everybody else. They must have done some practice that would have taken the place of metta. So what were they doing originally? You know, is there any understanding of that?
Yeah, I don't think that's a nerdy question.
Okay.
No, because you know, I've always thought that the Buddha's life wasn't a metaphor. That it was actually instructional.
Yeah.
You know, like if you actually look at his life and the Sangha and what they did, I mean, it really is instructional, you know? So I've tried to find something that answers that question. And I don't know anything instructional or procedural. I have not been able to find it. And I've asked this of a lot of people. And the closest that I've come, and I mentioned it, is that sutta on preventing conflicts in the Sangha, preventing and resolving, where he says that, you know, when you're with members of the Sangha, you know, you should be radiating metta to them. But beyond that, there's no, you know, instruction book.
Maybe just got lost, or maybe...
Yeah, because we know that all kinds of stuff was lost, right? And it was an oral tradition, and somebody's making a decision about what to save and what not to save, but what we do know is that of all those 22, there's no instruction book on metta, you know, nothing about visualization, what have you. So. Right. Yeah, that's right. Right. So. Okay. So listen, thank you very, very much for coming tonight. I hope you, the fourth Thursday of next month, I'm going to start wading into this topic of dealing with kind of difficult life challenges and raising a bunch of questions and then talking about specific processes or techniques from a Buddhist perspective. And then that Saturday one day is going to be devoted just to that topic. So I'm looking forward to that. I hope it's rich. Excuse me?
Next month.
Yeah, not this month. Not this Saturday, but
September.
So thank you very, very much. May all of us be safe and protected, and may all of our efforts individually and together make a true difference in the world in relationship to suffering. Thank you very much.